Welcome to the Imperial Healthcare Business Podcast. My name is Ivy Adedugwe, and I'm your host for today. This is our special episode celebrating women in healthcare business. Today, we have two wonderful guests with us. Our first guest is Miss Beverly Chesram. She's a consultant neurosurgeon, and she's currently working at the Aga Khan Hospital in Nairobi, in Kenya. She did her neurosurgical training in the United Kingdom, and did a score-based fellowship in Cardiff in Wales, and went on to do a global health fellowship in Tanzania as well, which is in connection with Wellcornell University in America. Our second guest today is Ms. Lolem Ngong. She has an extensive CV working in the global health space. She started off working in the CDC in America and went on to become country director for PEPFAR programs in Congo and in Ghana. And she ended up working with Gavi Alliance, which is the vaccination organization.
She's now the chief of staff at AMREF organization. This is a healthcare organization that works with the principles similar to the World Bank. So in organizing human capital and financial capital and organization in the healthcare space. So very welcome, ladies. I'm so looking forward to our conversation.
So we'll start with our first question. I'll start with you, Lolem, if that's okay. Can you tell us about your career path so far?
Thank you. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation. So starting with my career path, not sure where to start. Maybe I'll start with just my formal training. Yeah. So I trained as an epidemiologist, always, I wanted to be in health. So I initially started off wanting to be a doctor and really thought that was what I was going to do with my life. And of course that changed somewhere down the line. And really good, great for me that it became public health. Public health has been extremely rewarding, extremely fulfilling. I started off, I trained as an epidemiologist and somehow ended up in a little bit of public health communications by accident. And then ended up where I am currently in health policy. I landed in health policy about 7 years ago and have not left health policy. Throughout my career, I've worked primarily with the US government until about 2.5 years ago when I went into public-private sector, and then now I'm in the NGO world. So that's just a quick summary of my career.
Yeah, that's a very quick summary. So I would like to go into a little bit more detail.
You can.
Can you kindly tell us about, you know, how you started working at the CDC?
Sure.
In America?
So CDC, honestly, I figured when I was in graduate school, when you're in graduate school, everyone says the CDC, the US CDC is the place to kind of hone in your public health skills and practice what you've learned in the classroom. So in my mind, I figured that was really the only clear public health path, particularly because of my training. So as an epidemiologist, I knew if I went to CDC, I will be spoiled for choices. And so I was extremely intentional about working at the CDC. I really only looked for positions advertised at the CDC. Even after, so prior to the CDC, I actually was working as an epidemiologist in academia. And while in academia, I just kept applying to positions at the CDC, kept networking with people who worked at the CDC to find out what else do I need to add to my CV, where do I need to publish, et cetera, et cetera. And really that was, I think, talking to people, seeking out mentors who really guided me and gave me some pointers around the way, including, you know, past professors, equipped me to one, prepare for working at the CDC, and also just gave me the additional courage and courage to not give up on applying. And so I did just like probably the majority of people do, apply for a posting and was lucky enough to be selected. And my first entry into the CDC was in the Division of Tuberculosis Elimination. So for about three, four years, I worked in tuberculosis elimination, particularly focused on foreign-born persons. So that's how I got in.
Yeah. And then you went on from there to working in with PEPFAR, or was that Gavi first?
Yes. So it was PEPFAR first. And PEPFAR first because even before going to the CDC, so let me first say I'm from Cameroon, and I always knew that I will return to an African country. I didn't know which one. I didn't care which one. I just wanted to be back home on this continent, because I've always, even till now, I'm still a firm believer that, you know, my skills are best put to use here. So in everything I did throughout my career, I always thought about, you know, well, how do I return and how do I give back to my immediate community? The only difference is that my immediate community was just, you know, Africa-wide. So it wasn't even just Cameroon. It was wherever I can land, I'm fine. So I was always very intentional about global health. I learned a lot about global health, read a lot about global health. And, you know, when I worked for CDC, I always looked at different ways to apply that knowledge in a global setting. And when I say global, primarily an African country. And you know, would just that strong interest. And at a certain point, I decided, well, you know, now it's time to make the move. And I just put word out there, again, networked again, tapped into mentors again, and said, I think I'm ready. You know, don't care what country, don't care with who, would preferably like to stay with the US government, because I did really enjoy working in government. So I wanted to stay in government. I wanted to experience what it would be like working, being an employee of one government, working in another country, and having to really nurture bilateral relationships. So I applied for the PEPFAR position in Congo DRC. And I applied for that position because it had, one, it was in such an interesting setting. Congo is, and I till this day, I always say, even by the time I got to Congo, I was probably, maybe 10 years into my career in public health. But I still say, even till now, 15 plus years later in public health, that Congo was the best learning ground I've ever had when it comes to public health. Wow. Everything from the experts that are available to teach you, from the complexities of working with government, from just a diverse community, diverse in terms of socioeconomic status. So Congo is just a perfect learning ground. And I thought, you know, this is really where I would like to be for that reason. And, you know, so applied and got the job and packed my bags and moved to Congo. Knowing nobody, knowing nothing. No, had a friend in Congo. Aside from that, knew nothing about Congo than what, you know, I read in books or saw on the news, which was very dire and very discouraging. And nobody was helpful. I mean, even my Congolese friend said, you know, why would you want to move to Congo? And I moved to Congo, and a 2-year plan became a 3.5-year plan in Congo. And it was great. I mean, it's one of those countries that has always stayed very close to my heart. And it's also one of those countries that I wouldn't mind returning to work. It is an extremely fulfilling experience. And so after Congo, you know, I haven't returned to the DRC, to the US since then. It's just been all work outside of the US.
Yeah, no, and that's amazing. There's so much to unpack there. But just for our listeners, just tell us a little bit about what PEPFAR does for those who don't know.
Sure. So PEPFAR is the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. PEPFAR was U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and it was created under President George Bush Jr. And really, it was a way for the U.S. government, was a mechanism for the U.S. government to fund the AIDS crisis across Africa. I mean, at that time, we were seeing HIV prevalence rates in, you know, in like the 20% or 15%, wow, and so on. So it was truly, truly an emergency that was having a grave effect on communities, on health systems, and, you know, governments really didn't have the financing and in some cases the technical expertise. So that's why PEPFAR was created. So while PEPFAR is housed within the US State Department, it really is, the implementation of PEPFAR happens in, you know, just across the world. The largest number of countries that are served by PEPFAR are in Africa, but there are a significant number of countries in Asia, as well as in South America, and also in the Caribbean. So it's seen significant, there's been just significant progress over the year. A lot of countries have credited a reduction in their HIV prevalence to PEPFAR funding. So the program itself lends technical expertise to countries. It provides different guidance. It works with government to create different policies, from policies to protect key populations, policies to protect transmission of mother to child transmission of HIV, et cetera. So that's essentially PEPFAR.
Yeah. And that's such amazing work that's very much needed, you know, on the global health stage. So I'm going to come to you, Beverly. Tell us a little bit about your career journey, because I was just reading the article in the Journal of Neurosurgery, where it says there are 243 female neurosurgeons across the African continent, and over 20 or 30% of that is in Northern Africa. Tell us about your journey to being a neurosurgeon in Kenya.
And so I grew up in Kenya and then had the opportunity to go and do my medical school in Southampton. And I literally went to medical school with the intention of having a public health career. So you can see how great that turned out. And when I was in medical school, I did a project I had a supervisor from the MRC, Professor Coggan, and Dr. Richard Godfrey. Dr. Richard Godfrey was inspired me to think beyond my borders. He used to do work in TB and go to Eastern Europe and had actually spent 2 years in Kenya. So under their guidance, I came and did adolescent sexual health project in Kenya. And that was a public health project that got an award for that. So I thought, you know, my career is made. But by the time I finished, I did realize that I liked working with my hands and was looking for a career that would lead me in that direction. So to make a long story short, I ended up doing neuroscience F2. F2 is like your early years training immediately after your internship at the Walton Center in Liverpool. At that time, I thought I was going to do ophthalmology because we had seen Sight Savers and other people travel around the world. And I thought, you know, this is a really good way to do eye surgery and see the world and help out and do public health in eyes. But I fell in love with neurosurgery there. I think I had some really inspirational teachers, and I thought, let me do this. The challenge at the time, of course, is at that time, there'd never been a Black woman get formal training in the neurosurgical scheme in the UK. So I got some what I would only call very caring people who told me, it's never been done before, it's going to be a hard slog. Which is like, you know, just giving me fire, you know, putting engine in my fuel. And so I did what needed to be done. It took me 3 goes to get into the program. I had a lot of learning to do. And during that time, I got some of that learning by working at King's College in the IHDU, and then I did a early years training in Cardiff. And just like Lolem had said, you start with an intention, but you've got to do the groundwork to get in. And I needed to build my CV to reflect the same. I needed to have mentors and referees. And so that took me a bit of time to get into the program. And I was very fortunate to get into it in South London, which I completed in 2017, and then had the fortune of being the Pioneer Skull-Based Fellow under the program created by Miss Caroline Hayhurst and Pablo Gertz in Cardiff, Wales. And then when I was coming towards the end of that, once again, the itchy feet came into my life and I was like, what am I going to do? And I thought if ever there was a time that I wanted to go and see what else was available with the skills that I have, that was the time. Incidentally, when I was in medical school, I'd already looked into going to medicine sans frontières. But then I was very, very clear that a surgical career is not normally, particularly neurosurgery, is not normally on the path for MSF. So I Googled and I came across Professor Hartle. And Professor Hartle has, Roger Hartle, has been running a long-term collaboration with Tanzanian neurosurgeons. And I got accepted after a series of interviews. I had to fly over to meet him in Portugal for a face-to-face interview after multiple interviews. And I got accepted and I spent 11 months at the Mohimbili Orthopedic Institute as their global fellow. I was the second female and the fifth. The first had been Maria, who was in Portugal. Interestingly, that's how we met. And while I was there, I'll talk about that later, but it was quite an eye-opener. And then I decided to stay on the continent and moved over to work at the Aga Khan University Hospital here in Nairobi.
Yeah, and yeah. I must say, for those who don't know, the Aga Khan Hospital is a very famous hospital in terms of healthcare on the African continent. So, you know, the statistics in terms of being female and being a neurosurgeon are dire to start with. And then being a Black female, you know, who has trained in the UK, I'm not sure I met any other female Black neurosurgeon during the training when I met you. You can tell me differently if there was any other person.
So there's only two of us who have finished our qualifications.
Yeah.
There's Patricia, I'm forgetting her second name, who's a consultant up in Preston. And she's from the Caribbean. So she is the pioneer Black female within the UK neurosurgical space. And then I became the second. I was the first one to be accepted formally into a training position. Just to contextualize it for the viewers, the listeners, should I say, the United Kingdom has a workforce planning where they give a certain number of training posts every year. And so at the time when I was applying for my training, there was only about 16 posts for the entire United Kingdom. So 60 million people, 16 slots a year. And so the odds were pretty steep either way. It's one of the most competitive to get into. So, yes, I do happen to be the first Black female to finish. And I hope not the last, because that would be a shame. I think when I came to the UK, the one thing I didn't realize is that Black people and generally people of color have been in the UK for over four centuries. So when you hear that you're the first, it's nice for you, but then it raises the question, why?
Yeah.
Why so long? The people, yeah, of various backgrounds have been going through.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, it certainly is a healthcare issue in terms of the gender disparity in, you know, for the workforce, because if over 60 to 70% of new medical students are female and we're not creating a pathway for, you know, female candidates to go into surgery and especially neurosurgery, then it's going to be a crisis at some point when we don't have new people coming into training, essentially. I mean, I think...
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. No, sorry. I was going to say at the moment there's a little bit of a double... Yeah. So because of the workforce planning, at the moment, the UK has a certain surplus of people who've completed the training who are not yet fully absorbed in the service. And maybe I can use this opportunity to put out a shout out and say the rest of the world needs you. If you can move So don't feel like you have to stay in the same geographical location. But we have come a long way. When I started training, I only knew, and actually I wrote down their names, I'd only met Miss Caroline Hayhurst, who then became my mentor, Miss Charlotte Ward, who is now one of the most senior female neurosurgeons in Manchester, and Miss Samantha Hettiger, who is now a consultant in Georgia. And these three women made me think, well, I think this is possible. And now, last year, but one, for the first time, 50% of those selected into neurosurgery are female, 8% of consultants are female. So we're coming, there's some way to go. But even when we're talking about getting, so the challenge with diversity is not just a black and white thing, that even within that pool, there needs to represent the general population. So we do need people who would be considered ethnic minorities to step up and do this so that the conversations can widen about people's experience of healthcare, to bring new ideas on board. I'm all for opening up that space.
Yeah, and I love the work that you and a few of the other female African neurosurgeons are doing, you know, Claire and all the others, in terms of education, in terms of being role models, in terms of opening up the conversation in the first place as well. So thank you so much for doing that work. So I'm going to ask you the next question, which is, what would you say has been the greatest hurdle or challenge that you faced in sort of your career progression?
So I'll put it into two main topics. The first was self-doubt. When I was in medical school and the first time I read about neurosurgery, there's a book called So You Want to Be a Brain Surgeon. And when I read about brain surgery, that was the first thing I crossed off. It was a careers book. The first was self-doubt, which is, I'd never met someone who looked like me, so I thought, this is not possible. At the time, there was no neurosurgical training offered in Kenya. I didn't know any. So the lack of visible role models for me made me think that this was something other people do. And when I say other, I meant people who live in Western countries. Because if I watched a movie or something like that and there's a brain surgeon, they were more likely to be in a Western country, they were more likely to be male, they were more likely to be white. So I just didn't see a relationship between that. But then the words that my father told me when I was very young was, who you think you are who you think you are. In essence, your own mind limits what you can achieve. So the first thing I had to get over was my self-doubt. The second was the boxes. And what I mean by boxes is that when people, I probably need to contextualize it. I don't have brothers. So at home, we didn't grow up with gender until I was older. And because I grew up in a majority black country, I was never defined by the color of my skin. So when I went into the space where I was a minority for three reasons, I was foreign born, I was black, and I was female, I found that there were people who already had preconceived ideas about what the achievement of somebody like that would be. And that's what I call the boxes. So there were very many, many people who said, oh, where do you come from again? Oh, you really, really need to learn about infectious diseases, or you really, really need to get a job that makes sure that you're home in time to cook for the kids. Or this is not the kind of job that, you know, people who are not from around here get. And the challenge with that, with those boxes, is after a while you start to believe them. So that took me a while. It also means that particularly if that voice of the person who's putting you in a box is a dominant person. What do I mean by that? Somebody who mentors people into a training position, somebody who's on a selection committee, somebody who because there's always what you call hard opportunities. You get a training position or not, and then there are the soft opportunities. Do you get invited to that meeting? Are you invited to that coffee? Do you get introduced to the chair of the other hospital? All those little things that together chart the path of where you end up with. If somebody's put you into a box and limited you with that, then you don't get those opportunities. So those are the challenges I had, being put in boxes that were never mine to fit in.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. So I'm going to ask you an off the chart question, which is, which box did you think was the most limiting? The being female, the being, you know, the race box, or, you know, the not being a local person box?
I think they're cumulative. Yeah. And the reason I think that they're cumulative is that they change your experience. So one of the things that I found very interesting when I was in university is that people tend to just stick with what they consider their own kind, you know. And that means that many international students end up just existing in a space that's full of other international students. Yeah. Now, if you're trying to leverage yourself into opportunities in the widest sense, that's a challenge because you need a gateway into understanding what does it take for me to be able to access position X or Y. And the thing that really opened up the space for me is when I did my internship, we lived on site. Those are the good old days of when a house officer literally had a house on site. And living with my colleagues. So the last year of university, we all got mixed up. And that was the first time we started talking to each other, conversations that that went beyond my group. And then in my internship year, the same thing happened. I got to live for a year with people who had very different experiences to myself and who'd never really had an opportunity to ask questions about my experiences. And that way I started being introduced to things that I need to do and how I need to get to do them. But often that conversation is happening later on in your career. And that has been a theme throughout my training. It takes that much longer to even find the door you should be at, leave alone opening the door. Yeah. And then one of the challenges that happens, of course, is when you're, I think this is particular if you're foreign and female, if you think that if you're good or you do the right thing or you work hard, that's going to leverage you to the next position. But no, you need to do a bit more than that. You need to do some networking. You need to stand out in some way or the other. And you're so busy trying to keep your head down that you will pass for that stage, but not necessarily get to the next level because you're not doing all the other extras that gets you ahead of the competition.
Yeah, and you summarize that so beautifully in that your social equity and how you gain that is often limited by the box you're in. And that's what creates the glass ceiling, really. So thank you for sharing your experience on that. So I'm going to come back to you, Lolem, and we're going to sort of chat a little bit about the work you did with Gavi.
You know, wondering what, life would have been like to be at Gavi at this time. A really challenging time, but also I can't imagine being at Gavi and really being at the forefront of ensuring that people get the vaccines they need, making sure that countries are prepared for immunization and so on. Hats off to all of my former colleagues at Gavi. When I was at Gavi, I was a senior country manager and my portfolio included Eritrea and Uganda, really interesting countries, very different from each other, but nonetheless, amazing countries to work with. And so part of the work that Gavi does, and Gavi is very big on recognizing, of course, the importance of countries being in the driver's seat. Now, we all know, in some ways that can actually be done. In other ways, it's a big challenge because the countries themselves are not funding the vaccine or they're funding a smaller portion of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So while I was at Gavi with my portfolio, so my task was really to have these very strategic conversations with governments on, everything from the strategy to meet their targets. And of course, at the time, the majority of the vaccinations were childhood vaccinations, right? So these were your, MMR, of course, not polio, that didn't apply to any of my countries, but that applied to like Nigeria and India. Yes. And so these were all vaccinations that you and I would have gotten when we were kids. And so Gavi's goal is to ensure that every child is immunized. And prior to joining Gavi, I had never ever had any exposure whatsoever into the vaccine world. I mean, I of course knew immunization from primary healthcare, but not steeped into the work of, from when a country has a vaccine, an immunization strategy, which has to include supply chain, supply chain, making sure that those logistics are working, make sure you have the right cold chain. I mean, now everybody knows about cold chain because of the Pfizer vaccine. So we now understand the importance of cold chain. But before joining Gavi, I didn't even know, you know, all those technicalities, if you will, that need to be in place before you actually get a jab in your, whether it's your arm, your thigh, you know, wherever. And so it, you know, that experience, working with countries really, you know, it gives you, it's a very humbling experience when you see, when your first thought about vaccine is, well, there's the vaccine, now go off and vaccinate. And when you're actually on the ground and you see healthcare workers, now Eritrea, for example, it just has mountains, right? It's beautiful, lots of mountains, lots of hills, and vaccines to communities. You see mothers gathering and really keeping that vaccination schedule and knowing that vaccines will be available on Wednesday at 2 at this place. So they need to gather, you know, but there's a healthcare worker or community healthcare worker who ensures that mothers are aware of that or caregivers are aware of that. So it's really a humbling experience. And one of the things we've been saying at AMREF is, you know, talk to as work with government is, you know, it's not about the vaccine landing. You know, like Kenya received these vaccines, I think, 2 days ago. But it's not about the vaccine landing. It's about how are you actually going to immunize people? You know, have we done enough? Have we sensitized communities? Have we done all these things? And that's also part of Gavi's work. You know, so Gavi pushes demand creation, pushes community sensitization. How do you get communities to accept vaccines to, and how do you increase vaccine uptake? So, you know, Gavi's role just in immunization in general is extremely critical. And of course, as we see now with COVID and the COVAX facility with Gavi, WHO and CEPI, I mean, it's extremely critical for vaccine equity. Without that facility, where would some of the countries who can't afford to pay, you know, at a drop of a dime, like, you know, the UK did, US did, and buy these large doses and even buy 5 times more than what they need. I mean, you know, I mean, there are very few countries who can afford to vaccine hoard. And so, you know, the role of COVAX in coming in to say, you know, we're not leveling the playing field, but we at least need to ensure that these other countries are included in the planning and these countries do get the vaccines they need is one that I think it's so essential and it's core to any kind of vaccine plan that we have specific to COVID, of course.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. And again, for our listeners who may not know what Gavi stands for, so it's the Vaccination Alliance, which is mainly of NGOs, so the Gates Foundation, and mostly government organizations coming together. So yeah, I mean, that, it sounds like, you know, there's a lot of work that's ongoing, and I know you're not working for Gavi anymore, but you know, your expertise in terms of being able to just comment on that was very useful. So then we'll just come to the work you're now doing with AMREF. So tell us, you know, what AMREF is and what, you know, what AMREF does as well.
Sure. So I now refer to AMREF as the AMREF group because, you know, of course, I haven't had that conversation with our CEO to tell him, you know, I think we should change the name of AMREF. So AMREF Health Africa, we are basically a one-stop public health shop. And I say a one-stop public health shop because there's the NGO, which is, primary, it's the biggest chunk of the organization. So there's the NGO, there is our university, and it's a University of Health Sciences, AMREF International University. We have AMREF Health Innovations, and in AMREF Health Innovations, we basically take interventions that we think have made an impact in communities, and we see how to bring them to scale. And one of our interventions has been extremely useful during COVID. So we had come up with two digital platforms to train community health workers and other health cadres on just different things. So from community-based surveillance to diseases, to how to educate the community and so on. And the idea is you're able to use these digital platforms, and they're just mobile platforms that require very little internet, can work offline, et cetera. And we just thought, we can use this to quickly train people in hard to reach areas. And then here comes COVID. And this is like the key training tool, because of course you can't have that face-to-face interaction. So that has really expanded, and we've used this to, some countries have asked us to integrate it into WhatsApp platforms and so on. But AMREF Health Innovations really is it's very much our technology and innovation arm for all the work we do. And then the last one is AMREF Flying Doctors, which is really where we started. So we started off as AMREF Flying Doctors in 1957. And our founders, this wanted to come up with a way to reach all these far-reach communities and provide healthcare. And so over time, we then grew into now the NGO, the this, the that, and all those different arms, but we still keep AMREF Flying Doctors. And right now, what the flying doctors still do provide medical services with vaccine delivery in Kenya. And so we do still provide those services. And in addition to those services, so in addition to providing providing health services to farther reach communities, we also do medical evacuations across Africa, to Europe, etc. So we're big. We are headquartered in Nairobi, have always been in Nairobi. We are the largest international NGO that's based on the African continent. We have 11 offices across North America and Europe. And we also, in Africa, we have about 8 country offices, but we have programmatic presence in 35 African countries. So regardless of where you are, well, except for the 15 plus countries, but at least in 35 countries, there's an AMREF footprint somewhere. And, we basically, like I said, touch almost every aspect of public health. And our goal in everything we do is to ensure that we're bringing healthcare closer to the communities. So regardless of what it is that we do, it's very much community focused. It's very much community driven. We're very focused on community health systems. We work a lot with community leaders and with community healthcare workers. And definitely with this belief that, when you empower communities and you educate communities, then at a certain point, they don't need your help. You move on to the next community or to the next thing. But it's really, how do we empower communities? How do we ensure that communities are getting quality healthcare services? And that's what AMREF does.
Yeah, and that's amazing, because it's all about the sustainability. Because often, many organizations go into sort of, low resource environments, and there isn't any sustainability to the programs that, mm-hmm. that are in place. So it's very nice mm-hmm. to hear and refreshing to hear the work that AMREF is doing. What has been the challenges that you've had, during the pandemic?
So many. work challenges, I will say, I think probably for any health-related public health organization, the demand and the sheer amount of effort that is required has been daunting. I think, you know, when you have, for example, a disease outbreak. So let's say there's a cholera outbreak, right? You know, like the cholera outbreak, we know, well, there's a team at the Ministry of Health that goes out. You have your epidemiologist who's trying to track, you know, where did it start? What do we do? Blah, blah, blah. Your team of, you know, whether it's nurses, doctors, or whomever, who are responding. But that those frontline responders are, you know, are very focused. They've been prepared for this. They're ready to go. But when you have a pandemic, and you have a pandemic that is also heavily politicized, and a pandemic that is also, unfortunately, fighting with an infodemic as well, the challenges are just enormous, right? Because there's always a new thing. And also then in the course of that, we're all trying to learn this disease. Yeah. And every day it changes. And then now you have the variants. And so now we have to learn them and figure out what that is. So the challenges have primarily been learning and implementing at the same time. That's one. And then two, also being able to educate, revise information, but still reassure people, right? So, you know, we tell people, okay, you need to, you remember the very, 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 very start of COVID. We said, well, I mean, why wear a mask? You only wear a mask if you're ill, and so you want to protect the other person. And I even remember saying myself, well, you know, if you're not sick, why are you wearing a mask, right? Because everybody went into this mask craze at the time I was in Geneva. And but look at us now. You have to wear a mask. It is an extremely essential public health intervention. And then we add other things to this, right? And so the other day, a few weeks ago, when the CDC recommended wearing a double mask, I saw Dr. Fauci had to go on and clarify why the double mask, because then you have people saying, well, now you guys just need to make up your mind. The first time you said no need for a mask, now we need to wear a mask, now we need to double the mask. And then when you're telling people, we're learning as we go. Mm. Now, for you in the industry, that makes sense. But for anyone who's not in the industry, I mean, you know, we just don't know what we're doing. So that's a challenge in reassuring people that we're also learning, we're trying to do the best we can, and we're very optimistic that we'll get out of this. That's also difficult, right? I think another challenge is, you know, being able to on with the other essential services, because COVID came and COVID just kind of took over and dominated. And so for organizations such as AMREF, like for example, we had to be very careful with our response, because we had to ensure that, yes, we're dropping everything to focus on COVID, but we still have pregnant mothers that we need to tend to. We still need to make sure that our interventions in non-communicable diseases are still getting the attention they deserve. You know, our work in HIV, TB, our new work in climate and health, all of those things are still a priority, but we do need to support government's response to COVID. So that is also a huge challenge for us in how do we manage resources, and not financial resources, but, you know, people resources. So the first 6 months were draining. Sleep was definitely a luxury. But you know, those are the challenges, and that's also the beauty of public health.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so rewarding.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head on so many things there. So I'm going to come back to sort of the female aspect of being a leader and all the rest of it. So I'll come to you, Beverly. You know, you transitioned from working in the UK in the Western world to going to work, you know, back in Kenya. How did you, you know, build the global partnerships and relationships to make that transition smoother?
I started a few years before I moved back. So as I was getting to the latter parts of my training, I became more interested in what the opinions of other people were. So I started to attend international meetings. And while you go to the international meetings, I try to connect with people. One of the other things that I was also encouraged to do by my consultants is to visit other units. So I did a traveling fellowship to Bellaria in Italy. I spent some time in France with Sebastian Froelich, and I also went to the US and spent some time in Pittsburgh. And what all of them, all those experiences taught me is that medicine is not just a fixed science. There's an art to how it's practiced in different environments based on the cultural expectations, the resources, technical expertise. There are very many factors as to how it's practiced. The other thing is I'd always come back to Kenya most years. So I developed links with the neurosurgeons who were here, in the same WhatsApp group. So they became friends and colleagues in the widest sense. And the same is true for on the continental forum. So I started meeting people like Ignatius Asene from Cameroon and a few other people. When I did the Global Health Fellowship, I had no idea what it meant, other than I thought it would be an interesting opportunity to work in a different environment. And what I learned is quite quickly how to work with people in different time zones and on different projects. So although I was skull-based, a lot of the work was on trauma in spine and head. So you become flexible in that respect. So I started seeing what the surgeons do. And then also the other funny thing that I started to learn is when you define something as a problem, it's a problem to who exactly? Because you come into an environment and you think, we need to fix this. And everybody's like, no, that's not our priority. They don't necessarily tell you, but you quickly realize that you are pouring your efforts into the wrong direction in that particular project. So in terms of anyone who's trying to transition from one country to the other, my advice would be make networks widely. And that's easier now because we're going online. So joining different social network groups and things like that allow you to learn what other people are doing and eventually form friendships. There's a book by a lady called Linda Babcock. She's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. It's called Women Don't Ask. And it talks about how being nice to women isn't necessarily the best thing, that you need to leverage and ask for things, even if you don't get it. People are aware that you're asking for more and, you know, that you need to take more opportunities than you think. So I walked into global health without understanding what it was, and I've learned a lot and I still continue to learn a lot. So I'd encourage, you know, the women who are listening and the men who are listening just to try things. It's okay to learn and fail in the process you eventually find it. So I talked about networking. And the other thing is to know is that your views and opinions matter. So the other thing that you notice about what I've done is I led the first continental neurosurgical survey on the impact of COVID on the continent. And that only came from, there was a call out by one of the journals for views about people's experiences. And the one thing that I didn't want is for somebody else to speak on our behalf. And the only way to do that was to ask people to tell us what their experiences were. And we've got two papers out about that. And ditto the work that was led by Claire Karakesi that was involved in about the history of African female neurosurgeons. You might think that you're a minority voice, but actually your perspective and your opinions matter within the health space or whatever leadership opportunity you're doing, so that you should use that as your selling point to leverage opportunities and to open up doors.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, actually. And I think this also is something that you've mentioned before, Lolem, in terms of, you know, going to a new country and how you build partnerships, you know, across the board. And so basically not burning bridges and nurturing the relationships as much as you can. So you know, one of the things you said there, Beverly, was how you've actually gone on and created your own opportunities. And, you know, you talked about not being afraid to ask. What advice would you give to a young woman early in her training, you know, irrespective of neurosurgery, just, you know, any avenue, what advice would you give to them in terms of how to create their own opportunities?
So I think the first is to accept sometimes your journey may take longer than the next person. I think when we look at timed training or, you know, not all of us are Usain Bolt, but many of us can run and get something done. So that, you know, you just need to give yourself that space. It took me longer to finish my training. That's okay. I got there in the end. Two is leverage and relationships. So build a family around where you are. Many of us who are talking about this may be stepping out of our comfort zone. So maybe you're the first in the family to go to university, or you're the first woman, or you're from an ethnic minority. So the spaces you're trying to get into are very different from what you know. So leverage and relationships. I'll tell you, when I was trying to survive my residency, that's what happened. Things, little things like the nurses used to, maybe I shouldn't say this out loud, but the nurses worked out that I'm probably not eating proper foods. And this was in London. So many of them were, you know, mothers that feed. And so they used to take a rota and bring me food so that at least when I was on call, I had some food. You know, my neighbor, when I was doing my fellowship exams, my neighbors decided that no one was ever going to ring the bell when I was post-call or revising. So they took turns to get my posts and to make sure that things got done. I mean, these are, you know, elderly, I think it was entertaining for them because I was the youngest in the group. And so for them, it was like taking care of me. Or also, it's important to have someone you call a timeout colleague. In the process of what you're doing, you're going to have some really hard conversations and really difficult moments. You're going to fail at something, you know, you're going to operate on somebody, it's not going to work out. I have a series of people that I call when I need to time out. I need to talk in a very personal way. I need to cry. I need to vent. I need to figure out what I did wrong and how I'm going to get back on it. So build a series of people, you know, it shouldn't be one person because then it's just too much work for one person. But have a series of people that you can call at a drop of a hat that will support you. Step out and try things. As I said, I started out as in public health, into ophthalmology, into other things. You will find your path as you're going along. Steve Jobs has a really amazing thing about how he talks about his failing in college was what resulted in the beautiful type font that we have in computers now. He acknowledges that it's failure and trying that got him there.
Yeah. And I, again, you know, such wise words there. So, you know, I'm going to come to you, Lolem. What advice would you have for women who are wanting to work in a medical leadership role, you know, in international NGO space? Because I can imagine, you know, being a woman, being Black, being African, and coming from having had a foreign education and trying to come into these environments, there must have been some challenges in that.
Absolutely. So first, I will just echo everything that Beverly said. For all the listeners, that is extremely sage advice. I can't even argue with any of them because all of them I have used them from the group of people that are your core team that at 3 a.m. you can call and say, this happened. You know, I remember the first time I gave a media interview and it was, you know, completely misconstrued. And I, you know, just, I remember crawling into bed, my mother, and just crying. And it was my first time and I just was a wreck. So it's having those people, whether they're family or friends, completely echo everything you said. So I won't repeat that. But I think for women who want to be in leadership in public health, it is extremely, extremely important to commit to learning. You have to commit to learning. And when I say learning, not academic learning, but learning as in studying the organizations, studying people. Who's out there? Who's doing what? What are they saying? What are their views on this? You know, listen, when I was in CDC, I remember I had a boss who was very big on Twitter, and Twitter had just started back then. I thought, please, I want no parts of this thing. I remember him pushing our entire team to sign up for Twitter. Of course I never did. And, you know, fast forward how many years later, I don't have a lot of, I barely have any Twitter followers, but I follow so many people because I want to know who these you know, gurus of public health, what are their opinions? What have they published? What have they put out there? What are different agencies saying about, you know, X issue? What is Africa CDC saying? What are they lending? So that part of learning just never ends. And also learning even outside of public health, right? I had, you know, the privilege to sit in so many rooms with women who, you know, when they present, who can connect the, you know, who can connect, you know, economics and health and, you know, something in agriculture, and it all makes sense to the HIV prevalence, right? So when you see people, you know, this kind of segues into my second thing in studying people. So not only studying what they write, but when you're in those rooms and people are presenting, really studying their presentation style. What are the things they hit on? What drives home? What data are they using? So you see people triangulate this, all kinds of data from outside of public health and still bring home the point. And you kind of watch, and I've been mesmerized in rooms where you get kind of a window into their minds and how they think. I think it's key. I think the luxury we have now, except that we get, you know, it's quite exhausting, is that we now have, you know, Zoom webinars, meetings, conferences, whatever. And so we have access now to so many, you know, presentations, so many people that we would not have had access to. So I think really taking advantage of that is key. If you do want to be in a leadership role, learning leadership is important. And one of the challenges is, you know, I think leadership in some of our countries, some of our African countries, is abused in a way because, you know, we have some leaders who think, you know, to be a leader means you're in power, you can shout at people, you can be disrespectful, you can be, you know, all those things because you have the authority. And I think learning servant leadership is extremely important. Yeah. And I'm definitely a lifelong student of servant leadership because it has taught me so much. It has also changed so many things about the way that I lead. It's also just made me a better listener. And then one of the things that I knew I'd learned this from my dad, and like Beverly, I grew up in a house with no brothers, we're all girls. You know, and one of the things, right? And so the janitor gets the same attention to the CEO, they get the same attention. And I think that's really important in servant leadership. And the last thing I will say, there's so many things I could say about leadership, but the last thing I will say is, because I think what was a challenge for me is not only the way that we view leadership in some of our countries, like I said, but the other thing too is also knowing that as a woman, knowing that, and particularly for young women, knowing that you belong in that space. Regardless of whether, you know, you can't string your sentences together and you get nervous. And when you get nervous, you know, your palms sweat, there's, you know, sweat running down your back. It doesn't matter. Regardless of who's in the room, just spewing out these big words and using the most ridiculous vocabulary, it doesn't matter. You belong in that space, right? And you're prepared for that space. And even if you don't feel prepared for that space, you will prepare for that space. And all of that, as Beverly was saying, failure is extremely important. So all of those things, failing as you go along, will prepare you for that space. I have an aunt who, just has, is, you know, amazing, very poised, very experienced, very big in public health. And, you know, I mean, to me, she's just my aunt. But I remember one of my colleagues going to a conference and coming back to tell me about this woman they met, and she's from Cameroon. Of course, we don't have the last name. And she's from Cameroon, and she's this, she's that. And one thing she really loved about this woman was that she came into the room. A lot of them didn't know she was the guest speaker, the keynote speaker, but she just couldn't understand why there were so many women sitting in the back of the room. And she made it a point to bring the women up front. And when it came to the discussion part, she made sure that, you know those she made sure she included the women, right? And not necessarily in a very obvious way, but it was like, oh, but you know what so-and-so said, that was interesting. Can you expand on that? You know, of course, you also engage the men. We don't want to forget our men, but isn't ensuring that when you're in that room, you also pull other women into that inner circle, and make sure that you acknowledge their voice. Make sure, even if it's not out loud, even if it's after the meeting, pulling them to the corner and giving, you know, a person pointers. You know, the next time you do this, you know, think about 1, 2, 3. That has been done for me. And I was extremely appreciative. And just being open-minded with the journey. Yeah. You know, just being extremely open-minded with the journey. You don't know where it will take you, this journey of leadership. You don't know where it will take you. But just being open-minded to, you know, wherever it takes you physically, wherever it takes you. And, you know, mentally, emotionally, you're open to it. It's such a lovely experience with all of its highs and very deep lows, but it is definitely worth it to sit at that table.
And you just summarized it all for us there. So, you know, I would say if I had to pull from what both you and Beverly have said, it's that, you know, you build your social equity through the relationships that you build and you nurture. You create opportunities through that pathway. You keep open and keep learning. Failure is not final. Failure is just an opportunity to learn. Reach out, speak out, own the space. So yeah, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your experiences. Thank you for trailblazing in the fields and in the areas that you're working in. I'm sure many people will be inspired by your journey. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you.